we are seeing in this space 3 times the impact on learning at 10 times the scale for 1/100th the cost per student. We're talking about 2% increase in GDP per capita simply by moving kids from weak instructional programs to high quality instructional programs.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. In one sense, it was business as usual at the Education World Forum in London this May. At the world's largest annual gathering of education and skills ministers, this year's theme was building stronger, bolder, better education together. But the context was far from routine. The conference took place against a backdrop of global funding cuts to education programs. The Institute for Economics and Peace estimates that more than 35 million children around the world depend on foreign aid for their basic education. So how can policy be strong, bold, or better in the face of these cuts? Ben Piper was at the conference. He is Director of Global Education at the Gates Foundation, a panelist on the Global Education Evidence Advisory Panel, GEEP, and a lifelong advocate of foundational learning. When he was back home in Kenya, he spoke to me from his garden where, as you will hear, the local wildlife was keen to get in on our interview. Ben, a lot's changed since 2024, but the challenges in education seem to remain. Now, last year, we interviewed Robert Jenkins of UNICEF about what he called the global learning crisis. Do you agree? Is there a crisis?
Well, I've lived on this continent, sub-Saharan Africa, between Ethiopia and Kenya for the last 14 years, and I just think that despite some progress, children just are not learning. The talent level is very high, but we've tried to solve the education crisis and education problems primarily by getting kids into school. That problem has largely been solved in sub-Saharan Africa and India. But despite those efforts, there still remain millions of children who attend school, both in sub-Saharan Africa and Indian subcontinent, and just haven't learned how to read a basic paragraph or solve a basic math problem by the age of 10. And I think, again, because I've lived on this continent for a long time, I have had the advantage of being in many schools, but also the disadvantage of seeing the heartbreak of a child who looks like my son or my daughter, actually just struggling with those basic facts. I was in a Southern African country a few months ago in a fifth grade class, which is higher than we normally work. And you saw children, even in a middle-income country, fifth grade class, just really struggling to do basic subtraction. So yes, I think the problem is there. And I would really say that it's the defining problem of the education sector for our time. It's just an unacceptable thing that we're in. It is a solvable one because we actually know a lot about the evidence base for how kids should learn and how teachers should teach. So I think the failure to use that evidence-based instruction is the principal cause of this crisis. And I think particularly now that we do have evidence of programs that have reduced or pretty much eliminated this learning crisis, we have a better understanding of the science of teaching and that the skills that these kids need are taught in a logical progression. So fundamentally, the answer is yes. The crisis is still there, but it's a solvable one.
Very relevant to that was our conversation last October with Noam Angrist about his research showing the gap between policy and practice, which is not the same everywhere. And he was talking about how the difference between the haves and the have-nots in low-income countries is widening. It sounds like you agree with Noam's argument.
Well, I just was saying goodbye to my daughter. She's off to university. She just graduated from high school.
Congratulations.
Yeah, she's going to a great school in the U.S., which is all a celebration. But I will take you back a little bit where when she was about 6 or 7, she was struggling to read. She has a father who has a doctorate in this stuff and a mother who is a teacher and educator herself. And we struggled to teach her some of the basic things that her siblings really found quite easy. And it turned out with some assessment around that age 6, 7 period that she had pretty severe dyslexia, along with around 10% of kids in the rich world. And she's U.S. by passport. And that 10% number really sticks in my mind because 10% of kids, given the right instruction and the right support, struggle with dyslexia or similar learning difficulties. And the exact opposite, going to Noam's research, it's the exact opposite. It's 10% of kids who actually hit very basic benchmarks in sub-Saharan Africa. So my daughter, with the right support, with the right talent, around her with the tutoring. She had the innate skill. And as you can see, she's going to a very good university now, but she needed the better instruction, the better support. And that's what that 90% of kids here in Sub-Saharan Africa and 70% in South Asia, with that right instructional support and the package around her, she and others like her will catch up. But that really depends on policy choices and really depends on the kind of galvanization of the broader sector.
Yes, we're going to be talking about those policy choices, but one thing that clearly is new in 2025 is those aid cuts that are going to be happening. So whatever the scale of the challenges we've been talking about so far, how much worse have they been made by those cuts?
So I think what we've lost, if you take education as a sector compared to other sectors that have also been affected, particularly by the U.S., let's start with there first.
Yep.
The U.S. is... contribution to education aid is a little bit less than it is in health. But for this issue of how to improve learning, it's actually a bigger part of the intellectual contribution of what we know. That said, the global aid cuts are a real challenge, but I'm seeing this as kind of a catalyst for innovation. Just being at EWF last month, you know, it was 120 countries, but I spend most of my time with African ministers, talking with 10 of them in one-on-one meetings. And I think there's a real consensus that, yes, it's a disaster. There's no better word for it, but also a catalyst for some of the innovation that I think the sector has long been overdue on. And I think it's an opportunity to take a fresh look and to do things differently. And I think the commitment of these ministers, we actually had a session with them in Parliament, Tim, where these ministers were talking about their prioritization of this issue of called foundational learning, that in their countries, making sure that every child can read and do basic math by the age of 10, grade 3, approximately that age, is a priority for them. But they felt like some of the big donors, USAID being one, but also FCDO secondarily, have left them behind. And it puts the onus on us in response to them. So it's a different kind of relationship. So for these countries that are prioritizing this issue of improving learning and doing that with real political commitment and utilizing domestic budgets to translate down to what the kids need in the classroom, there is a different place potentially for philanthropy. So we can never do what these bilateral programs did as the Gates Foundation or any other philanthropy, but we can be more catalytic and supportive of government prioritization and provide that kind of technical wraparound support that the governments are asking for because they are prioritizing these issues. Governments prioritizing foundational learning is exciting on the one hand. Their demand for more support on the other is pretty clear. And finally, I think what I'm really excited about, having led a large USAID-funded program in Kenya and other countries in Sub-Saharan Africa, the talent that was doing these really remarkable learning improvement programs were entirely African. I was the only non-African. And so the best people in the world who know how to improve learning outcomes at large scale exist in Sub-Saharan Africa and definitely exist in South Asia. It's just being able to find the mechanisms and structures that would allow that talent to support governments directly, but really in response to real government leadership and ownership of these issues.
Ben, you were talking about foundational learning. You have a strong commitment to that, and we will be talking about it a lot more in this conversation. Can you define what foundational learning is for me?
Sure. Some of the definition comes from the name. It's the sort of thing that you build on. And why is that? The Gates Foundation in particular is committed overall across sectors to empowering the very talented individuals in these parts of the world with the tools they need to reach their full potential and lift them out of poverty. In the education sector, investments in foundational learning, which are about setting these kids up for success, not only in their education careers, but also in their workforce, leading to growth for themselves, leading to economic growth for their countries, to productivity and better health outcomes, and general better opportunities. So what does it practically mean? It means that in order for the building of high-quality education to work, you need a foundation of, can you read, can you write, can you do basic arithmetic? And everything else that the education system is working on right now depends on that foundation. And so foundational learning is providing the super talented but not yet instructed well student in Sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia to have those basic skills. Pretty remarkable to me, having married into an Ethiopian family. The talent level of these Ethiopians is pretty extraordinary. It's kind of intimidating to go to these family gatherings where, you know, it's PhD this and PhD that, and engineer and doctor, you know, these are elites, but they're not elites. They're people who came from rural Ethiopia and just have worked hard. Foundational learning is about giving every kid, whether you're in a rural school or an urban school, whether you're from a wealthy family or a poor family, the same chance to be able to access the rest of education, whether it's science or whether it's AI or whether it's the arts. You have to have these basic skills. And these kind of foundational programs have really had meaningful impact. There's some recent evidence that would suggest that better access to foundational learning programs that are effective could boost the lifetime earnings on average by around 3 or 4% and are extraordinarily cost effective with a 30-to-1 return on investment. That's a CGD, Center for Global Development analysis, making them some of the most cost effective social sector interventions. There's literacy on the one hand, which I've spent a lot of my career focused on, but also math. If you think about being able to do these basic analyses, understand number, being able to compare numbers and do basic math facts, it's the first step to STEM. Clearly, STEM and access to STEM is one of the things that's making countries competitive right now. And so these foundational skills is the first step to STEM and the knowledge economies of these countries, which are increasingly part of a global economy and really need those skills, not just for the 9-year-olds, but also for the 20-year-olds in the future. Just to be clear, we're interested in foundational learning because obviously it's a human right to be able to read and do these basic skills, but it's the ability to become proficient in these things and independent readers and do math with understanding that unlocks your ability to read for pleasure. I'm reading a new book. I'm reading for pleasure, but also being able to compete internationally. You fundamentally need to utilize some of these proven practices, proven evidence-based instructional methods that have the biggest impact. But foundational learning is the first step and everything else depends on it.
The international community's done a good job at creating more access to schools, putting more kids into schools. But at a policy level, to create foundational learning within those schools, what needs to be done and who does it?
Well, that's a good thing in some respects, because I feel pretty strongly that the people who are needed to do it are the existing teachers.
Right.
You can work with the existing personnel. It's just providing them the right support and the right understanding of what they're trying to do and how to do it. So the program that I led in the past called Tusome, which is here in Kenya, was an instructional program that was supporting every public primary school teacher and every public primary school kid between grade 1 and 3 with better instructional material. So it's not like you're creating something brand new, but it's a better book for the kid and it's a better teacher's guide for the teacher and providing that in every school. And then after that program held out, learning outcomes doubled in 1 year. And that's at a national scale. There's some very recent evidence from India on a program that used something called structured pedagogy, which showed that this is an ASER study, which is done by Pratham, which is the biggest NGO in India. And it's just measuring basic skills at a grade 2 level. And the last assessment, Tim, was just before COVID. So we're a little bit worried at the end of 2024, whether or not the outcomes would have caught back up to pre-COVID times. And in fact, what we found is in states that implemented this structured pedagogy program, which I'll explain to you what it is in a minute, their outcomes not only caught up to COVID, but also were the best that Pratham's assessment had ever shown, that the outcomes had improved more than they ever had. And the gains were actually twice as large in public schools as they were in private schools, because it was public schools that had taken this government prioritization of foundational learning more seriously and had really made it kind of a cornerstone of education. So what does it look like? It means kids get books. Those books are well structured and sequenced. They take the science, you know, if you look at it from an academic point of view, have like this big spreadsheet of all the best of what we know about how to improve learning into one package. You put that spreadsheet and you don't see it in the textbook. The textbook looks beautiful. It has pictures of kids. It has pictures of kids outside playing. But underpinning each of the lessons is a big, carefully designed scientific spreadsheet that gets the kid access to their skills as effectively as they can. So the kid has a textbook or a workbook in the Indian case. The teacher has a teacher's guide, which gives them some structure of how to teach a lesson every day. And then the teacher has support in the form of training to understand how to do each of these instructional routines. And then also classroom support in the form of coaching or other methods to give the teacher some practice with the skills. And that sort of approach is not that complicated or, to be honest, Tim, that new, but doing it at that scale has been what's really cracked it, both in Kenya and in India, to have large-scale learning improvement.
And between what ages does this take place?
Years differ a little bit, so it's either 6 to 7 to 9 or 10. So if you're foundation phase, lower elementary from an American point of view, first cycle in Ethiopia, depending on what you call it, the kind of 6 to 7 to 9 to 10, somewhere in there. because it's the time period where kids are learning to read so that you then can read to learn. So somewhere around that grade four period is where kids need to have these basic skills to be able to learn new content and need to have the basic numeracy skills, both in number sense as well as computational ability to allow them to access more complex math.
Now, as I mentioned, Ben, you're a GEEP panelist. We've spoken to some of your fellow panelists before about how GEEP evaluates policy. And you have this concept of smart buys. What is a good return on investment in education? So is the return good for this? Is it a smart policy choice?
So yeah, I think what GEEP has done in their last report is characterize two particular in learning improvement interventions as a best buy. So these are best buys because they have rigorous evidence, which is the best high quality studies supporting them, as well as the pretty careful analysis of the cost per child per year. And so we're saying that two interventions have meaningful impact at scale for $8 to $10 per child per year. And the two interventions are called structured pedagogy, which I just mentioned about a moment ago, and something else called targeted instruction, otherwise called teaching at the right level.
Right,
that one, teaching at the right level, is grouping kids by their skill. And so if you have a pretty wide range of skills in the classroom, making sure that those who need to practice their letters are practicing their letters, while those who are reading full stories get to do that on a daily basis. Those are two interventions that across South Asia and across Sub-Saharan Africa have consistently shown impacts. And they are ones that actually are helping, as we said earlier, the existing teacher to improve their teaching. We're not replacing those teachers. We're just helping them to do better. And I think it has the potential to have real lasting improvements in student learning outcomes and provide the seed not only to help that individual teacher, but have the entire education system work better. One thing that got launched actually last week at EWF in London was a new GEEP paper on literacy in particular. So what we were trying to do there was take the current evidence that are 70 new studies from these countries, particularly low and middle income countries, and see if the evidence about how do you improve literacy is substantially different for these low and middle income countries as it is in the US or UK. Because a lot of what we knew about improving literacy was drawn from those two countries. And as you might know, English is not similar to the rest of these countries as other languages. It's actually quite a difficult language. It's a less transparent, far less consistent language. So we were able to update the evidence on literacy to see if it changes when you focus on languages that are quite different than English. And the highlight of that paper is that, yes, the basic ideas remain. That's actually quite encouraging, that every kid needs to make sure they have practice on decoding, being able to figure out how these letters make sense into words and whether those words put together to make sentences. And at the same time, every kid, regardless of language, regardless of location, needs to have practice developing their oral language, oral vocabulary. So the specifics differ by country and by language, but those two components are applicable. Now, without getting too much into the details of that paper, it's really important for everyone to know that learning Arabic in grade one is different than learning English in grade one. And similarly, my wife's Ethiopian. Learning Amharic, which has an alphabet of 200 plus letters, is different than it was for me to learn 26 letters of English. But the core elements remain, and the best evidence about how to improve those languages was laid out in that new paper.
Now, it sounds like you have an excellent evidence base for the effectiveness of these learning techniques. But I guess with the reduction in aid funding or the elimination of aid funding, then a lot of policymakers will be looking at what is the benefit for our economy? What is the benefit for our country of investing in this? Can we estimate a return on investment there?
Yeah, I think recent evidence is pretty exciting about that. So let me give you one sentence that has three numbers in it. Ready? I work in the global space, and I also used to be a teacher in the US. So if I compare literacy and numeracy interventions between low and middle income countries and the US, these are three things to think about. On average, what we're seeing, our programs are 3 times more effective at 10 times the scale or 1/100th per student cost. So this is on average. Again, there are programs that are more effective than this. But on average, compared to the US, we are seeing in this space 3 times the impact on learning at 10 times the scale for 1/100th the cost per student. So we're in a kind of a pretty sweet spot. Education has not been typically a sector that's easy to have program impacts. But in this window, foundational learning, and in these contexts, we're having pretty extraordinary impact. And that's on average. Some are bigger, some are lower. Another way to think about this is if you think about a standard deviation, which is kind of a measure of difference, a standard deviation gain in literacy and numeracy could have a 2% rise in GDP per capita. I'm seeing some policy shifts in the UK. I'm an American. We're trying to see what we can do to get 0.5% of GDP increase. We're talking about 2% increase in GDP per capita simply by moving kids from weak instructional programs to high quality instructional programs. Overall, particularly driven by low and middle income countries, we would see overall global GDP growth increase by $6 trillion or more if all children acquired basic literacy. And again, all we're talking about, if you go back to my daughter, is the talented kid who's being left behind because they're not getting the right instruction. $6 trillion. So yeah, it's fundamentally a growth-friendly reform, and it has real return on investment that's pretty substantially higher than most infrastructure projects. I know countries are trying to weigh different choices. Do I make new schools, or do I make sure that these kids have quality? And actually, we're going to be coming out pretty soon, Tim, with some evidence about how much marginal cost it is to have a high-quality program over a low-quality program. Because a lot of countries already have the core elements. You have a teacher, you have some book, you have some instructional support program. Adapting that book to a better one, providing that instructional support program to be more effective, the marginal cost per school and per kid is probably not that high. But I think the evidence is pretty strong that the benefits are going to really have really high return on investment, fundamentally.
So Ben, you mentioned a couple of countries in which these programs have been implemented. As you look around, is there a single model for implementing foundational learning, or is it very country specific?
I would put my answer somewhere in the middle of those two opposites, Tim. So look, in the countries where you've seen substantial political will, governments have decided this is their priority. They use the evidence to determine the structure that they're working on, and they have some measure of implementation quality. You can see transformation of learning outcomes within a 2 to 4 year window. I gave you the example of Kenya early on. But the 2 to 4 years in most countries is within an election cycle. So that person in power could actually see some benefit to them in that time period. So again, the India one is one that's top of mind for me. I just had another call about some upcoming very good evidence about foundational learning improvements in India. But what India did starting off was pretty substantial. They set up a new priority for government and their new education policy, which was this issue of foundational learning. Unless we fix this, everything else in that new education policy won't work. So they created this mission, which is called Nipun Bharat, which is the FLN mission. And as I said earlier, the kind of national energy around improving literacy and numeracy has meant that these outcomes in 2024, they were released just a couple of months ago, had the highest national percentages of grade 3 literacy that they've ever reported and the highest national numeracy rates that they've had in over a decade. And then some of the states like Uttar Pradesh, where we have a couple of very good partners working with Uttar Pradesh. And I know, Tim, Uttar Pradesh is a state with 230 million people. Yes. So it's 2/3 the size of the U.S. And in that state, we saw learning outcomes triple since 2018 in both literacy and numeracy. So we're getting substantial improvements at large scale in complex places using these sort of approaches. Of course, having been to Uttar Pradesh relatively recently, and having been to Kenya relatively recently, since I live here, there's differences. But the kind of core evidence base is quite strong. You might have a different structure for how you get instructional support to happen. Some are using coaches that exist. In India, some states have created a new cadre of coaches to provide instructional support. But this idea of having some feedback mechanism and loop to the teacher, giving the teacher new materials that are evidence-based and having the student with something they're looking at or working on every day, that package has consistently shown impact.
Now, Ben, you're locally on the ground. As you say, you're in Kenya. I imagine some people might be able to hear the wildlife behind you. It looks fantastic. For the Gates Foundation, your involvement in this, what is your role? What's the role for other NGOs at the moment in helping governments to implement these programs?
I'm really proud of the work that the Gates Foundation does and making sure we're thinking about how this does differ by country and how leaders in the country can make sure that the specifics that they're dealing with drive everything. And while no two countries are exactly the same, we're actually working with those partners on the ground to showcase the scaling pathways that will not only work in their country, but also be a regional exemplar. There's some partners in Senegal, a local organization called ARED, that is really showing what it means to work embedded in government, bringing the science of education to the Senegalese context, and then really being an exemplar of how you work with government across the sector. To answer your question about what's the role for philanthropy or for implementers, governments have to be in the driver's seat. And that's one of the things that I think is a really big emphasis in this kind of recent shift with donors scaling back. The role of philanthropy is to be catalytic where the market is failing and really to innovate, right? The right sort of money that my organization provides are how do you build the evidence base that works? How do you help countries think about leveraging ed tech and AI? How do you help collaborate across philanthropy in a way that hasn't happened in the past so the country can feel that they're in control and they're not trying to manage 20 different partners doing 20 different things? So I'm actually, as a development professional and one that's loved working in this sector for the, I don't even know, 20 plus years I've been at this, also excited about some of the changes that this shift provides us the chance to do. And I'm really excited to be part of the foundation who is listening to government. Right now, Bill Gates and the Africa office is working very closely in Ethiopia and Nigeria to listen to the heads of state there about what they see as the new world. When I was in EWF with the ministers there, my main question is, what do you see as the way forward and how can philanthropy help? So we really are excited about being at the forefront of this shifting relationship between donors and countries and think that we can play a role at the innovation space of how do you take that priority of government, which is really clear. I think one of the things we've seen is that there's a set of nearly 30 African ministers who have said that foundational learning is a priority for them. It's their idea. And so we, as well as other philanthropies, can come behind them. Excited about that. And as I said earlier, also really thrilled about the idea of having as much of this being led by African organizations rather than the global ones.
Your catalytic involvement, how long does that last for?
So I think that will differ by country. And what's exciting for right now is we have a new strategy approved by Bill Gates that we were just announcing that will continue to focus on foundational learning. And we've picked a few focus countries to really start with. And we'll be with these countries for the next several years supporting them. As you've seen in the bigger announcement, the overall foundation is continuing its work for the next 20 years. So we can do more in the short term. So we're really excited about trying to increase progress as much as we can in the short to medium term.
So when you were at the conference recently, Ben, and you were talking to those education ministers, how receptive were they to what you're saying? But also, how optimistic or pessimistic are they about their ability in the current situation to implement it?
The good thing is we have the advantage. I have relationships with several of these ministers over the last few years. Mm-hmm. So we have relationships where they can tell me the truth of what they're worried about and what they're feeling confident in. And I think that we shouldn't hide it, that there's a real loss of expertise and a real loss of resources. But what I'm excited about is that many of these ministries have already found places in their domestic budgets, as tight as they are, or places with the large multilaterals to pay for some of the core elements of these evidence-based approaches. And I think what they are desperately asking for the listeners of your podcast and for the other philanthropies, other technical experts in the sector, well, I think the word was, don't abandon us. We do know that development needs to change, and I'm personally excited about thinking about how to do that. But I think these countries are not wanting to be abandoned, but they want that to be in a different relationship where they're at the core. They're the ones making the decisions, and that we as philanthropy and as we as technical support are in response to them. I'm as optimistic about this work as I've been in a long time, not because the resources are what they used to be, but because the ideas are flowing in the right direction. The ideas are flowing from Sub-Saharan Africa and from South Asia to us, and then we're trying to find ways to help them rather than the other way around. And I think that's going to have a longer-term impact so that these programs are not only effective in the short term, that can have some evidence that shows up in the next JEEP report, but also can fundamentally shift this problem of foundational learning. Progress is possible, even in the short term. But all of us do need a sense of urgency. Right now, as we're on this podcast, there is some child who looks like my daughter or my son who's in a classroom that just isn't learning, but we know how to fix it. But for that kid next year, even if we might have missed this kid this year, but that kid next year, we should be able to have better programs and better government-led interventions that can make sure that we'll be just on time for the next kid.
I'll let you get back to fixing it. Ben, thank you very much for talking to me today.
Thanks a lot, Tim. Pleasure.
This This has been a Vox Dev Talk, the best way to make sure you don't miss an episode. Follow us, you'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. And our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org, where you'll find articles about the topics that we feature. And if you like what you're hearing, please tell someone else about us and leave us a review as well. Vox Dev Talks is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zargarian. Thanks to Oliver Hanni and Iman Siddiq at Vox Dev.